Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That's Cameron Brock. We're still a week away from the drop of the 2024 UFA schedule for all 24 teams, but we've got plenty to talk about in the interim before then. Not a whole bunch of league news, so Cam and I wanted to get into the blueprint for what it means to be successful in this league. It's felt like with such a preponderance of New York Empire success, it's been a little bit fogged up as to what's really brought us to this point as far as what teams are successful and what makes them successful and get to that point. You know, in New York and their discipline and talent combination, it's just felt like something that has been so visible and apparent over the last 2 to 3 seasons. But as Cam and I have talked about offline for the past couple of days, it's not something that I think is as readily apparent as maybe as we've always talked about in a narrative sense. So what we wanted to get into here today was talking about the elements, again, the blueprint for what we think would make teams successful both in the pre-modern era, kind of before the 2019 season, and then working into where we are now, because there's a lot of through lines and connecting elements that sort of bring us from the advent stages, the 2012, the 2013 seasons, to now into 2024. So without too much further ado, I kind of wanted to kick it over to Cam and give him a chance to talk about being a member of this league since its day one inception, what it's been kind of like to evolve over the past several seasons, and what are some of the characteristics that we've seen commonplace in developing winners in this league, because as we're going to figure out, it's been drastically different from what it was in the first 6 seasons compared to what it's been in the last 4. And what we then love to do is bridge the gap from what has made teams successful in the past to what they are now, and then who we expect to be successful going forward. Who are the teams that we feel carry the elements of what will be successful and allow them to have sustained success, in this league going forward? And again, without too much of my own words, I want to kick it over to Cam. Cam, thanks again for being on this episode. As always, what do you feel like has been kind of the story before now as far as what was to be successful in the UFA versus what it is now in the league that makes teams be able to win games? Because I obviously have my own take, but you being on the field for, you know, some 200 plus games, what is it that makes a winner in this league? You know, you've made it to championship weekend, you've been to a bunch of playoff games. What is it? What are kind of those quintessential points that really unite winners in professional ultimate?
Yeah, I haven't quite been on 200 games, but I did look as we were getting ready for this podcast.
That's too many.
I did realize that I have played more games than more than half the teams in the league have played total. So
I feel like I saw this NBA stat, Chiron, that was LeBron James has played against a third of all NBA players who have ever suited up in the league. And I feel like you've got to have a stat similar to that the UFA. I know we don't have as much interdivisional games, but sure, you've got to have some sort of like collective played against 40% of all total league members ever, something like that.
Yeah, and it helps that some guys shuffle in and out of the division. So, like, I've seen them at one point. Like, if they've been in our division, I've played against them. So, So, as I was kind of researching for this and we were talking about this, it became one thing that I was really trying to think about early on was like, what made teams win back in the day? Because we've talked about how teams have become way more efficient and just better top to bottom as the league mm-hmm. has aged. And when I really thought about what was happening in those early seasons, it actually was a pretty clear-cut answer for who was going to win every year. And that was the team that just had the most talent. It didn't really matter if that talent was there every game during the season. Roster consistency seemed to be way less important. What mattered is that when championship weekend rolled around, when the playoffs rolled around, if you had your top guys available and there, that team won. So when you look at 2012, the best teams in the league were all out east. You could probably make an argument that the top 3 teams in the league were coming out of the east. two of them ended up in litigation and weren't really even available for the playoffs. But the Philadelphia Spinners were a team that was definitely looked at as being top dogs for pretty much the whole year. They proved as much in the championship game against us. Same thing the next year, Toronto Rush enter. GOAT is in, you know, what I would consider kind of their heyday. Like, they have Mark Lloyd, who was just, you know, probably one of the top five greatest players to play in our league up to this point, if you ask me. You could make a strong argument that outside of Bo Kittredge, he is the best player if not best player, at least one of the heaviest, most biggest impact players, I guess, is what I'm getting at. That guy was an absolute monster. Toronto was a top five team in blocks their first, four seasons, I believe, in the league, 4 or 5 years. And when you look at the numbers during that time, blocks were a highly correlative stat to how well a team performed. People didn't value the disc as much back then. The throwers weren't as precise back then. And I think what happened a lot is you had these teams that were just better athletically, better game sense. They were just better players. They were just more talented. And even though teams weren't practicing as much, teams weren't as cohesive, when that's the case across the league, you're going to win out just on talent. And if you go through every year and look at the rosters of the teams who won the championship from 2012 to 2017, you will find every time the team with the most talent. And it wasn't until 2018 when Madison won where I would make an argument that they weren't the most talented team in the league. They were certainly a top tier team in the league when it came to talent. But I think you could more easily that year make an argument that some other teams may have had more top end talent, but Madison was a kind of the first team to really break through and value the disc a way no other team had. The first team to crack 60% for an O-line conversion percentage. For the record, most seasons before that, the highest team in the league was in the low to mid 50%. So that was quite a huge jump. And since then, we have just seen a whole different way of winning. It's not just about talent anymore, but that's what everyone relied on in those early years.
Yeah, I think you bring up some great points. I think another element too, there's talent, there's those blocks. Another thing, size. You know, you go back and you look at Toronto's preseason stuff before 2013, and they have interviews with Mark Lloyd and Thompson McKnight and kind of these like old head legends of pre-modern UFA action, where they talked about recruiting in that first season for athletes who could cover the increased size of the professional field and wanting players who could kind of eat up discs in space. And as they showed, as you just mentioned, in those first four seasons, they led the league in takeaways. And that just set up so much of what they were able to accomplish in those first four seasons. I mean, New York right now, for all of the accomplishments and pedigree that we assigned to them, they're still tied with that beginning era Toronto Rush win streak record of 30 games. I mean, the Rush outright owned the East Division up through the 2018 season when New York finally broke through, won their first ever game against the Rush in that season's East Division championship game, made their first appearance at championship weekend since 2013 when the East Division had two bids. Toronto took one, New York took another. You know, it's so funny to, I think, encapsulate now where we're on the back end of this dynastic reign of the Empire over the last four seasons. You know, you talk about four straight championship appearances, three titles, two back-to-back championship wins, and that, again, 30-game winning streak carrying over two consecutive seasons, and yet the Rush were doing this at the beginning of their tenure in this league, and it was sloppy, kind of. We I think, sort of almost denigrate some of their successes because it was in this era in which there was so much slop disc. There was so much just inefficiency, lack of attention to possession, and it wasn't until, to your point, kind of the 2018 Madison Radicals where the meta finally shifted over into an offensive era. And we saw from kind of 2018 up through about 2022, this really predominant style of reducing mistakes on your offense, pushing efficiency. Obviously, turnovers and other things are important, but kind of superloading on the offensive side of the disc. And I think you've seen as a result of that, and I'm sure you can corroborate this on the Alley Cats, there's been sort of this lineup adjustment of shoving all of your stars on offense and letting them kind of figure out how to power the entire team from that position. And it wasn't until, as we talked about two episodes ago in our defensive sort of coverage episode, that in 2023, that narrative started to finally shift. And it's just, it's really interesting how we already see now in just 10 years of this league, 10 plus years, I should say, of this league developing, that we've had kind of this response of defense, takeaways, pre-modern era sort of slot ball, that's the meta, to then there's this kind of offensive evolution, efficiency, and now we're kind of getting the next response, which is maybe in our defensive era, maybe back to takeaways, break rate, the ability to muck up an opposition's offensive attack being the predominant form of how you succeed. It's just, it's already showing that there's this continual kind of cat and mouse strategy between either side of the disc. And it seems like that's going to only continue going forward. But what I want to kind of bring you back in on was, you know, you talk about talent being so indicative. You talk about the takeaways, size. It felt like in the pre-modern era, it was so much more alchemic. It was so much more like cosmic, the way in which these teams came together. You wouldn't really, quote unquote, know until the postseason and their top lineups took the field how a team like the 2014-2015 Oakland Spiders would take form, how the 2016 Dallas Roughnecks would take form, how 2017 San Francisco Flamethrowers RIP would look, because in their regular season formations, they were kind of these lopsided rosters of who could be active and who couldn't. And they would get, you know, their talent surge in the elimination games, but it would just sort of, there was a lot of play that was indicated by highlights. I feel like in the first several seasons, it was sort of like you could watch a highlight reel and surmise who the better team was. That started to fade a whole bunch. There is a huge discrepancy right now, I feel like, in the league between who makes big plays and who is successful. You look at New York, you look at DC's, you even look at Salt Lake, etc. These are boring teams to watch at times, quite frankly. They are execution-heavy teams. And so I kind of wanted to bring you back in about, again, the pre-modern notion of what it was to be successful and what kind of, more importantly, you started to describe at that hinge point in 2018 was, what sort of was that change that brought us from this kind of almost rock fight style that I often like to characterize pre-modern or even still Central Division games with, versus what we kind of see more developing league-wide as far as efficiency, turnovers, putting pressure on opposing offenses via pulls or something else. There's so much more refinement of the game. Can you talk to us about what kind of was that shift and what you noticed in those years, maybe from 2016 through 2019? What kind of was it like playing through that shift?
Yeah. So one thing that's really interesting, like with that shift, right, is you there were a lot of players that didn't survive the shift. Whether it's because, you know, like to be completely honest, right, the league became more efficient. And if you were a player who wasn't efficient and refused to kind of get on board with efficiency, then you just kind of got beat out, or you just weren't good enough to be on the team anymore, because it was no longer just about talent. It was no longer just about like, I'm a great athlete. Like you also had to be good with the disc in your hands, or at least good enough to get the disc back to somebody else and complete the next pass. And that's just not something that you can't be inefficient in today's game. And that's where it kind of all started. And I really want to point out Madison, because Madison was a team that dominated the Central Division. You know, they won the Central Division what, 2014 to 2018. I believe they finished second to Chicago in their inaugural season in 2013, although they did end up making it to the championship game that year against Toronto. And the thing that really set them apart from pretty much every other team in the league was their roster consistency year to year, not just game to game, but year to year, and how innovative they were trying to be with this new rule set, this new field that people were still trying to figure out. They were the team, you know, you look at Atlanta now, who does this zone man back and forth game on defense pretty much throughout the game. Where did that first start? In Madison, and they perfected it. And we talk about size. That's so important when you're running a zone. And they had these two massive men in up in front in that double team, and Andrew Weber, and although Meshnick is not...
Max Weber and Andrew Meshnick.
Max Weber and Andrew Meshnick. I was getting their first names mixed up there, sorry. Yeah, with Weber and Meshnick up there, Meshnick isn't that tall, but he's deceptively long, like his wingspan.
Yeah, he's got an ape index of like a 7 foot NBA center. Like it's astounding. I think they call him a little bit like Mr. Fantastic on the
park, yeah,
where his limbs just kind of extend when he needs them to.
Well, and they have guys like Scott Riggles, who's like 6'7", Dave Wiseman, who's not sure what, 6'3", 6'4". I mean, they had so many large bodies they could put out there, and they had some people on the back end who were athletic, like Peter Graffy, never going to be confused with a great man-to-man defender, but man, you give that guy some space to go jump up and get a jump ball, like he's great at that, like in putting him at the back of that zone where that's all he had to worry about was perfect for them. And it wasn't actually until 2018 when he moved over to offense and he became one of these super efficient offensive players that they really took off on offense. And we saw that 60%+ conversion. To put some things in perspective, something that had never been done before, we talked about how great the New York Empire were last year in that game against DC, you know, not what having like 7 total turnovers or whatever the number was.
Four.
Sorry, yeah, you're right. Four. 1 quarter.
It's worth noting. It was 4 in a 48-minute regulation game.
Four, you know, we played against Madison in that division championship game to go to championship weekend in 2018. They had 8 total turnovers for the game, and I believe 5 of them were defense. So their O-line turned the disc over, I believe, 3 times the entire game. Even if we converted all 3 of those breaks, that is not enough turns to win a game on. I mean, I think we lost that game by 8 goals. They were just so efficient, and it was something that the league really had never seen before. But that they had been building. They kept bringing this roster back. They kept innovating. They kept game planning. They were, I think, coaching-wise, they were the first team that had a consistent coach year to year who was also trying to be innovative with what they were doing on defense and the way the schemes they were running, game planning specifically for certain teams and what they like to do. And that's something that can't happen when you have coaching staff shuffling in and out all the time. When you have players shuffling in and out all the time, you're having to constantly teach systems. Instead, they were owning their system over years and years. And that was really the shift we saw where it's like, you can't just be talented anymore, because there were other teams in the league that year. You could make an argument that Dallas was more talented than they were.
We have a concrete example. The Flyers went and visited Madison in the middle of that regular season and absolutely Donnybrooked them in Breeze Stevens Field. I mean, I think that was the first time somebody had won a regular season game in Breeze Stevens since... I think it was the first time since 2013, because the only other time I can think of before that, because I was still during like when they were holding reign over the Central Division and beating all of you and your divisional opponents, was 2016 semifinals against Seattle. I think the only times they had lost up until that point were against championship contenders or somebody that appeared in a championship game. And then the Flyers came in with Jack Williams. Nethercutt had won the MVP the prior season. They had Jacob Fairfax. They had Misha, and they just routed the Radicals.
They I remember talking with the 80-yard flick bomb from Nethercutt to Terrence Mitchell that just was on everyone's highlight reel for weeks. Like it was just, and And it was just one of those things where the throw was perfect, and it was obviously the entire length of the field. And also Terrence Mitchell was just running away from his defender almost on his own. And they, yeah, like Raleigh that year was, as they were the Raleigh Flyers back then, they were better than, you know, as far as talent goes, they were a more talented team than that team. You could make an argument the Dallas team they beat in the championship game, they were, that Dallas was more talented if you just went straight up person to person and matched them up. But no one that year, regardless of how you want to argue talent, was as prepared, as cohesive, and as efficient as Madison was. And that was really where I see the turning point, where we kind of went from this talent-driven league where talent was really all you needed to, okay, now you need to have talent, but you also have to have a game plan. You also have to be efficient. You also have to be cohesive. Like, all these things started to matter as the talent level rose across the league, and as teams started to develop identities and become more serious about the UFA, because there was a time where it really was like most of the teams in the league, probably, maybe you practice once every once in a while. Maybe people are just showing up to games. I've talked to people who have played on other teams, admittedly, a lot of them weren't very successful, which makes sense when you hear that, like, once the season started, they basically stopped practicing. They would just show up for game days and that was it. And that just can't happen anymore. You can't just show up when you want to. You have to be there for practices. You have to be there for games. And if you have people, let's take Colorado for example last year, who are in and out of the lineup last year. Carolina is another great example where you don't have people coming to every game, where you have, whether it be injuries or people are just unavailable for whatever reason. And what ends up happening, you have these teams that are super talented that both of them lost in the first round of the playoffs and didn't even make it to their division championship games. And I would say if we looked at just rosters, I don't think anyone would disagree that those were clearly two of the best rosters in the entire league. And they lost to teams with inferior rosters who just, they were there. They showed up all throughout the season. They had more consistent lineups and they had game plans that seemed to make more sense. I will say even coaching decisions that seem to make more sense. Like, to me, the decision to not put Nether out there because he won't be available the next game is a dumb decision. You can't count on being in the next game without winning the game you're in right now. I don't care if he's not going to be there the next week. Put him out there on the O-line. Like, things like that that don't make a lot of sense. Like, I think you just have to be better at every level other than just, hey, let's just be talented. That doesn't work anymore.
And here's another thing I want to bring up about that pre-modern era again, kind of what we're talking about from 2012 through 2017, maybe even getting into 2018 again. No era is going to be cleanly defined by a year or a decade, anything like that. It's all going to be pretty fungible, right? One thing that we haven't really just hammered on, and I think it relates to this whole talent component, is the Bo effect. You know, Bo Kittredge, I mean, he won 5 straight titles. He didn't lose a playoff game during that stretch. He dominated this league in a way in which, if his shadow didn't recede so quickly, I feel like we'd still be talking about him. I mean, it's kind of even the enduring legacy of what he granted the Empire, which is their ability to overcome Toronto and get on to the apex level that he had kind of paved throughout most of his playing career, both collegiately, professionally, World's Gamesly, any competitive format you put Bo Kittredge in, he was liable to get a gold or a trophy in. It was so just kind of foregone knowledge at a certain point the first several seasons of wherever Bo is going to sign is going to end up. And kind of to your point, the time it didn't work out for him, basically, I need to correct myself. He won his first 4 titles without losing a playoff game. He lost in 2018, not to Madison, but to Dallas in the semifinals, but by a meta that eventually defeated the sort of talent wave that he rode to 4 straight titles from 2014 through 2017. You know, and then he got his 5th, famously, in his final season with the Empire in 2019, where they went undefeated. That's where I kind of lost a little bit of the thread about him being undefeated the entire time. He did lose a playoff game in his tenure in this league. One, he lost one, but just sort of the effect. Again, he was considered to be the pinnacle of our sport, arguably the GOAT in the men's division all time. And it just kind of followed that wherever he went, his gravity pull and ability to recruit and build just kind of this winning program out of the effort and just auspices of his persona just sort of followed him around. And it wasn't until somebody kind of had a strategy, to just beat that talent down that you could really do anything about it. I mean, even thinking back to that second half collapse in the 2016 semifinals against Seattle for Madison that was so defining to the culture that eventually brought the championship in 2018. I mean, they couldn't stop Seattle's playmaking in that second half. They had for all of their strategy against, you know, the interdivisional opponents of the Alley Cats and the Minnesotas, et cetera, when it came time to address Seattle's talent, there was little Madison had in their chamber to deal with that. And then you fast forward two seasons to them against Dallas in the 2018 championship, and they were almost making those Roughnecks players, Legion players now, puke on offense, running around in the heat of a fourth quarter trying to get open for handler resets and dumps. I mean, they flummoxed, like you said, maybe a more talented roster on Dallas by simply outworking them in the trenches and having strategies that disallowed Jay Froude from having another great game off of the back of his 2018 semifinals, et cetera, et cetera. I felt it would be remiss not to bring up the idea that there was a singular player that sort of almost encapsulated that entire era of just, you had Bo / the talent, you were going to win. You were going to win. You had a Bo level player on your team, albeit a Mark Lloyd or somebody else. Like it just kind of facilitated all of it because everything just kind of fell into place around that. And I think you still see vestiges of that, right? Like you still see teams, I think, trying to do a similar sort of quick fix to their lineups now where they want to bring in a star level player. And certainly there are examples of that working. Obviously LA brings in Pavel Giannis, re-signs Sean McDougal after he spent a season with their SoCal rivals in San Diego. And they get a huge injection into their success after missing the postseason for a couple of years. But there are other plenty of examples where that hasn't worked. And like you were just talking about a second ago, you know, the Colorados and Carolinas of last year, these are teams who have unquestionable levels of talent. And yet you look at the results, I mean, they had almost double digits combined losses between the two teams last year. I mean, you drop the 2023 Colorado or Carolina teams into any season pre-2017, and I think they're like running the table. Like, I think they're just wiping teams away. Yes. Even 2016 Dallas. Like, mm-hmm. I again, to your point, like, I think 2016 Dallas, maybe the most talented roster ever, but they didn't know. I mean, they were out there playing scrimmage ball. Like, you go back and you look at their efficiency numbers, it's kind of tragic. Like, it's a hard argument to make from an analytical point of view of that being the greatest team ever, simply because they didn't have the discipline or seriousness to take a lot of the simple possession seriously. And then you look at a team like last year's New York, I mean, they just can execute it. Anyways, way off into the weeds here. I wanted to try and bridge from that pre-modern era into modernity where, again, we've just seen this kind of paring away of the sort of simplicity of, oh, you can just get the best players and they'll sync up and you'll go on a run and it'll work. To now there's so much more blocking and tackling, so to speak. There's so much more X's and O's, strategy, health, fit that goes into it. I think one of the things that I'd love to transition into now is talking about these teams we feel like are maybe on the cusp of that, or starting to develop that kind of, again, like dynasty. Obviously New York has it, but that success. And I think we see that there, these teams are almost in these fitful stages And I want to bring up one in particular, Atlanta, who's kind of on this precipice or this kind of teetering edge of they obviously have the talent and they've been recruiting it into their region, both locally and semi-locally, you know, in the Southeast corridor. And they can't quite find that balance between what are sort of the foundations of commitment about showing up to practice, about being a part of this unit and chemistry versus just outright talent. And I think a great example, and we were talking about this pre-show, is Misha Freystadter. You know, this is somebody who arguably could have won the MVP two different years in 2015 and 2016 with the Cannons. I mean, he put up absolutely NASA level fantasy numbers. You know, he set the single season, he took your record of a single season goals, Mark, broke that. One of the most dominant offensive players we've ever seen in this league. In 2018, played for the Flyers, played defensively fantastically. He gets added to Atlanta before 2023, and it's like, my God, they're going to add this 6'7" monster to their roster. What ceiling do they have? And all due credit to Freystadter. He had a good season. He showed up. He had good games for them. It was hard to discern if he made a difference for their successes. That is mind-boggling to me. If you would have gone back to me at any year prior to 2019 and told me, hey, this already championship contender is going to add Misha Freystadter, I would have been like, all right, just punch the ticket. And it's like this past season with the Hustle, it felt like he was great. He was great in his role. But it made no waves. I guess what I'm wondering is, can you help me connect and maybe help our audience connect that difference about, sure, we can talk about, you know, the aesthetic differences between the pre-modern and modern eras. But like, what happens when we have this actual player who is showing us the similar output or efficiency, even a greater efficiency than he had before, and yet his impact is lowered. His like individuality isn't as well expressed.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes back to just the cohesiveness you need from lots of practicing and playing together. And although Misha was on the roster last year and played well when he was there, he wasn't someone who was consistently available. I don't know right off the top of my head, but what, he played in about half their games, maybe.
Not even.
It's very similar when they added Khalif the year before. Like, Khalif El-Salam, mm-hmm. obviously a very talented player, a guy who can be a difference maker. But if you're only showing up to three or four games, and I'm guessing you're not going to many practices, if any, like, what's that really mean in the long run? Because what's not going to happen is you're not going to have no cohesiveness and then show up in a big game and be the difference maker. You're really only on that opportunity to do that might be on the D line, just because if you are a very talented defensive player and you're out there on like a man to man line, you know, you don't necessarily need all the time as much cohesiveness with the team, especially in getting blocks. But even in that respect, like knowing how to communicate switches appropriately, knowing the wrinkles you might want to throw in. With Atlanta specifically, right? I mentioned in our defensive episode that one thing they did against us that I know they like to do is they would have the person who was guarding two or three in our vert stack. When a disc was thrown up field, that person would just abandon the stack and go double team. And now that creates a lot of problems because the double team isn't coming from the handler space, leaving the handler open. No, it's coming from the stack. And now if the person who's being poached off of isn't fast enough, right? Like now we have these problems. We don't know where to go with the disc. And when you put somebody out there who's not used to throwing these wrinkles in because they're not practicing, they're not going to every game, how much are they really going to move the needle? They have to play a simpler form of defense, right? They have to play on offense. They have to play a simpler form of offense. There can't be this nuance. There can't be these like almost back shoulder fade cuts that you make yep. because there's not that chemistry between you and the offense. So in the long run, yeah, you don't in today's game really move the needle because it's not just about talent anymore. It's not just about size, both of which Misha has in spades. But it doesn't matter if you're not going to move the needle, as you said, despite putting up great efficiency numbers, because those numbers just look different with him than they're going to look with somebody who's showing up all the time. And we see that across the board everywhere, right? Like Carolina has as much talent as anyone. They can go 25, 30 deep. like their 30 is as talented as most people's, you know, top 20, right? But again, if you don't have the consistent reps with people, it doesn't really matter. You can't just have Joe White show up for big games and think it's going to work out. Joe White's an amazing player. I mean, you could make an argument that he's one of the most impactful players you could possibly have on your team. But we run into the same thing where it's like now you're playing a different style of Ultimate when Joe White's in there. It is not the same as having Solyanik and, you know, MGH back there running things. It is different. It looks different. It feels different. You cut differently for it. And when you can't just turn your brain off and play Ultimate with a system that you just know backwards and forwards, it adds a lot more tension to everything. So even if you're converting at a similar percentage, even if things look statistically kind of the same, when you actually watch the product on the field, you notice a tangible difference in what you're seeing. So I think that's a really long way to say you got to show up for more stuff or you're not really going to make the impact you think you're going to.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And I'm also really glad to hear that in a roundabout way, you're kind of confirming that the argument I had last week about Thomas Edmonds not quite being the right fit for DC's offense is true, because he just hasn't had enough reps with that unit. I just also wanted to shout out because Edmonds was just recently nominated for Canada's Men's Ultimate Player of the Year in 2023. So huge shout out to Edmonds. Very deserving award for him.
The only thing disturbing is how much Thomas Edmonds slander is coming out of your mouth right now about him.
He just had so much stuff about reps and being there and everything. And all I could think in the back of my head was like, well, he's, you know, 6, 10, 12 games into his DC tenure. It's not long enough with that unit. But maybe in year two at the Breeze.
We're going to get a really weird intersectionality of fans now, because this is now the third episode we brought up Thomas Edmonds. We haven't even gotten to the season yet. So I feel like we're going to have some people. The Thomas Edmonds fan club is going to become our biggest fans. Like all the Thomas Edmonds fans, come on.
All the howling Canadians that come out of the woodwork, you know, they're a very boisterous fan base, those north of the border. But yeah.
So you mentioned Atlanta as like a team that kind of fits this. And like one thing.
And one more thing. I would be remiss if I didn't say, I just bring up Frey Stotter as one of the most intriguing examples because of his dominance before versus the impact they had last year. There is nothing but absolute respect for him. And I think of him as being one of the more technically skilled players, and I wish it was something that came through more as a general perception about how he plays, because he's a fantastic piece to add to any team. It was befuddling to me at certain times to just almost go look at the stats and look at the film and kind of try to, you know, synthesize the two and just be like, and it's, he's not appearing here. Like this, these aren't valuable counting numbers in any real sense versus what like maybe Max Thorne provided for their offense or somebody else. You know, it was just it was so weird to try to corroborate the reality of what I was seeing now with Frey Stotter's impact versus like what I remember from those seasons he had for so many years with the Cannons, where he's in triple coverage and you can't stop him, and that's exactly what they needed to be doing. But again, it was rock fight era.
Yeah, and so one thing Atlanta's done, like, to get to where they are now, like, it wasn't that long ago. Go back to the beginning of 2019, and I think most of the 2018 season, they were not a great team. And actually, we, the Alley Cats, were the inflection point, I believe, for them in the 2019 season, where they went from the first half of 2019 looking like this middling team. They were losing some close games, but their record was very poor. They come into Indy, beat us, and then the rest of the season, they look like, well, I don't think they actually end up making a playoffs, but they look like one of the top two teams in that division for the rest of the year. They play great Ultimate, and then that momentum carries through our missed year, our missed COVID year, and then they come back in 2021, and they look fantastic. And you're going to notice the one thing, you start to look at the rosters, they had a lot of people stay together, and over the last 3 years they've really had a lot of the same players be their big contributors, one big loss, of course, was Jaime, who went out to Salt Lake and enjoyed himself a nice trip to the championship game. But you take out Jaime, the rest of the squad basically looks the same. The big players are all there. They lose, you know, they lose Calvin Williams to retirement, but he kind of has helped usher in this new group of players, especially their Alabama contingent, which he was one of. They've got all these guys coming in from Huntsville, and they've really kept a lot of talent that's fairly local, despite the fact that they did bring in Khalif, they did bring in Amisha Freistadter, maybe some people who are traveling from further away and aren't going to be quite as available. But like, really, you look at, they built this kind of from the ground up to be where they're at now. It wasn't the old style of just collect a bunch of talent no matter where you can get it from. We see that this has actually led to the downfall of Dallas. Dallas for years was just talent coming from everywhere. Like, they win with Jimmy Mickle and Dylan Freechild and Bo Kittredge and Kurt Gibson, all these people who maybe aren't actually in the Dallas area, although Kurt maybe was in the area at the time. Who knows where that guy is at any given point in time. But they were collecting talent from outside of the area. And the thing that you can run into trouble with is once that talent retires or leaves or decides they don't want to keep making the travel commitments, you're not left with any pieces left in the local community that can come and like fill those gaps. But when you're doing what Atlanta's doing, where you're taking people who are all close enough that they can attend practices and they can develop with the team, develop into the systems, develop with the coaches, all of those things, they stay together and practice together through the off seasons. That pays big dividends in your longevity of how competitive you can be and how long you can be competitive for. This is actually, even though people don't really think about it, think the New York Empire are a great example of this. They keep the same players coming back year after year. You know, the Drost brothers, you talk about me playing in this league for so long, the Drost brothers feel like they've been, somehow been in the league longer than me, just hearing their names all the time. Maybe it's just because there's two of them, so you just hear the name more often, but those guys have been around forever, and they've carried, like, even since the early days of the New York Empire, you know, former teammate of mine, Ben Ivers, was out there, and talking to him about what it was like being a part of that team and just how expected it was for everyone to show up to every practice. Even before they became the Empire we know them as today, they built that culture, and so many of those players stayed with the team. Like, people probably forget how long Jeff Babbitt's actually been on the team. He didn't just burst onto the scene in 2019, which is probably when a lot of people
took notice. Yacht's been there for 8+ seasons now.
So, like, these things matter, and I think when you can get that, those players who are within a reasonable area where they can attend things regularly, you not only build up those players exponentially more than you will players who can't come to things, but it creates a longevity for the program too. You almost are building yourself a farm system of like, okay, when this player ages out, we have this player who can come in and replace them. And that's huge for not just being good now, but being good long term.
Yeah. Yeah. And one more player I would be remiss if not to mention in that original New York nucleus was Matt Lamar, who didn't miss a game in 113 games. I believe it's still the most active game streak in the league's history. He was Mr. Iron Man for just seasons, very unheralded part of their defensive backbone, and was, again, just part of that effort, along with the Drost, Matt Stevens, Matt Auletta, Ivers, kind of the faceless mob. Remember when the Empire were referred to as the faceless mob for their defensive efforts? Mm-hmm. Kind of funny now that they roster the last four MVPs and probably have five or six deserving candidates on their roster and are just, you know, a galaxy of stars unto their own team. It really speaks to, again, what you're talking about, that continuity of element. I feel like, you know, you talk about Toronto's and Madison's. They've sort of had this upheaval of not really having much of that going into this newer era. They're trying to still find that footing again. But I wanted to transition now, because I know we're kind of getting on into the episode about, you know, we've sort of been talking in all these different directions about what makes success, what's sort of bridged pre-modern to modern UFA. But now I wanted to kind of get into, with the outline of the blueprint of what might make a team successful, you know, this chemistry, this efficiency, this strategy now that the league is now imposing, in addition to the talent and the size and the athleticism and kind of all those measurables. What are the teams going into 2024 season that are going to maybe take hold of these opportunities? You know, obviously I think we have a crop of teams already sort of burgeoning into that space. You know, you talk about the DCs, the Austins, even the Colorados, but I kind of wanted to more get into a team that's maybe just starting to punch into playoff capacity. Maybe isn't even somebody that we're considering as a championship contender for this next season, but could be a team that evolves into something like what New York has accomplished over the last couple of seasons. Obviously, no one's maybe going to get to those quite heights, but has a chance of punching at that championship level. I wanted to give you the opportunity to just select your two teams, and then I'll take mine.
Okay. I think one, we saw them actually make championship weekend last year, maybe ahead of schedule, but like Austin Soul. The Austin Soul have been slowly building. And when you talk about Austin, one thing that they definitely have in spades is buy-in. Like, they are bought into Austin Soul Ultimate. Like, they show up, they practice a lot, they have a coach who's extremely hardworking and passionate and loves doing it. Like, Steven Nagy is as committed to the team as any player or coach across the league is. He wants Austin to be great. He believes so much in what they're doing, and he rallies players around that. Like, listening to players at championship weekend last year, like, really talk about like the Najee effect, basically. Like, he's so enthusiastic, and he takes losses as like harder than any of the players too. Like, to have a coach that is that invested and like feels it just as much as the players on the field, like, players for the most part really love that. Like, I will make a sort of a comparison here. He's kind of like the Dan Campbell, you know, if you will, of the AEDL. Like,
other than the Midwestern origins aside, I think that's so apt, because I think one of the things that I hear in what you're describing, one of the things that I've noticed so much about Najee, and you know him better than I do, is that he sets an expectation that I even think he acknowledges is above where he would realistically want to set it, and never wavers from that expectation. Mm-hmm. Like, yes, there is a gap between the reality and here. Doesn't matter, boys, we're shooting up here. Like, that sort of indefatigable optimism that he has in the ability to reach what is beyond their grasp, I think is maybe second to none in this league, having talked with him over the past couple of years. I mean, I want to be honest here, and I say this with all the respect in the world, it borders on delusional at times when you're talking with him, because he doesn't waver from it. You try to kind of be like, okay, Najee, but like, you know, like it's probably a pretty big task to overcome the Flyers. And he's like, nope, we're going to do it. That is our goal. That's where we're going for. And we're going to get there. And it's just like, man, I'll run into a brick wall for you. Like, it just, it washes over you, man. Like, it's such an effective form of coaching.
Well, and you look back in 2022 when they played the Flyers for the chance to go to championship weekend, that was a tight game for most of it. And if it were not for a dropped pancake catch in the back corner of an end zone, that would have, which ended up being a Carolina score on the other side. I mean, that was going to be a one score game with like 4 or 5 minutes left, right? Like,
I don't know. I felt like Austin was trying to do too much of the highlight stuff in that game still. Like, they still weren't the evolved form. They wanted to play make into a win, which you can do. It's just so hard against an opponent like Carolina.
Yeah. But they have all of the tools to be successful. They have a coach who's invested and bought in, who's going to come back year after year. They have players who are bought in, especially their top talent, their most talented players, the Kyle Hinkies of the world, for example. Like, these guys are bought in. They want to keep coming back, and they want to keep working hard. There's a culture of showing up and working hard and playing together and playing for one another. And the thing that's great about that is very welcoming to new players coming in, people who want to come in and work hard and eventually earn a spot on the team. And you have this guy, Steven Nagy, this coach who's the head of it all, who is extremely positive, not just in the way he thinks about his team, but in the way he communicates with his players, right? Like he believes in his players and he lets them know it. And that really gives them agency to go out there and just, not feel the pressure of the moment. And I feel like you can kind of see it in the way they play. Could they be more efficient? 100%. But there's something kind of almost intoxicating about like the freedom they all play with. And that when there is a mistake on the field, it doesn't seem like anyone is heads down like, oh my gosh, can't believe we made this stupid throw, dropped this pass. It just kind of seems like, let's just keep playing ultimate. We're having fun out here. We're going to keep playing our game. And, you know, it's going to work out more times than it's not that we're going to come out on top. And, you know, we saw that carry them to not just a championship weekend, but even the hot, they did get out to a pretty hot start in the first few minutes of that game before things went sour.
The Soul are on an obvious come up, but I've got to know, what is your other team that you really have your eye on as far as developing into a contender in this league?
Yeah, I'm going to take it out west, and we are going to look at the Oakland Spiders. The thing that's great, you go and look at like all rookie teams, right? We had Frankenberg having a fantastic season out there. Other rookies or just like players making huge impacts, like Dexter Clyburn, like that dude is so talented. He had a lot of turnover issues last year, but like I think fixing decision-making errors, like that's something that is you can work on and easily fix with just some coaching and some time looking at the film and realizing the impact of, you know, your decisions. Like that's something that's easily coachable. And he is so talented and I think has such a high ceiling that it's like one of those things where, hey, he had a turnover prone year. I expect next year to be 10 times better because he's going to have some experience in the league. He's going to be able to look back on some of those situations and just improve. You have Keenan Lawrence, who is just like, man, first off, that guy is always smiling. That dude is just happy to be
playing. Most positive guy. Yeah. Like just
happy to be playing.
He should just have like a general fan club. It doesn't even have to relate to him being a Spiders player or anything. It's just like a Keenan fan club. Go snowboard with him or something.
They have so many pieces too. Like they have Mac Hecht, if they can get him to show out for more games, which I'm really hoping to see him play 10, 11, 12 games next regular season.
He played 11 games last year. He played a lot of games.
He played 11. There's no way. Did I watch, like, I swear I watched at least 3 games he didn't play in.
Yeah, there was about 3 because they played 15 or 14.
They played.
They played 12, but he played 10. He played 10 games.
Okay. Well, maybe he wasn't as prevalent some of them as I remember. I don't know, but he... I think him, like he's kind of the, we talked about this in a previous episode. I think Mac Hecht is like kind of the cog that makes everything run offensively. Like when he's there, they just are so much more patient on offense and don't seem to rely so much on these big plays, which was kind of fun to watch. And like you mentioned earlier with Austin and how sometimes they try to play make their way into games. I mean, Oakland won a game.
Oakland is the biggest example of that. Like, all they want to do is try and dunk on you. That entire second half when they defeated Colorado at home is just them trying to dunk the Summit into submission. I mean, the amount of teenagers that sky out really good Summit players in the second half of that game is quasi-embarrassing by secondhand. Like, I would have hated to just be theoretically in the position to have those kids doing those sorts of things to me.
I think what they need, though, like they need, honestly, I played one game against Mac Hecht when he was in Detroit.
That doesn't count.
One game.
All right. Doesn't count.
No. Here's what I'm going to say.
He was on defense.
Here's what I'm going to say. He needs to play more consistently with that style of possession-oriented offense, because what happened when they got the disc, it was the best D-line conversion percentage Detroit has had in their losing streak, and it's not even close. And him and Johnny Bansfield would basically just play catch with each other, and they were just like, no matter what we do with this disc, as they should, and no matter what we do with the disc, we're completing it, right? And that's honestly the energy he needs to bring to the Spiders. They have so much playmaking. They have so much speed and athleticism that it's like, it's counterintuitive, right? A lot of people think I'm fast, I'm athletic, I should just run deep and catch a deep ball. But the same is true on the other side. Like, I'm so fast and athletic, I can kind of get open at will on an undercut. And like, sometimes I think younger players don't really think about it that way. They think about it so much in the, I can win my matchup deep. Why would I, you know, grind out, you know, all these in cuts over and over again? Well, because those are higher percentage plays. Those are, you know, you can just do that the whole way up the field, just churn, churn, churn. Next thing you know, you're getting an uncontested catch for a score on a 15, 20 yard throw instead of a 60 yard spray and pray, which can be effective. We saw them beat Colorado doing that, but it's not going to be the way you're going to win a ton of games.
Yeah. No, I, you know, Oakland is absolutely a team I would earmark for this exact discussion. I mean, I think they have that blend. You talk about the sort of veteran presences you mentioned, Hecht. Brandon Fine has been a part of that franchise since their championship years. They have a couple other elements on their coaching staff. I believe Matt Crawford, also from the Spiders championship teams of 2014 and 2015, is still a part of that organization. They kind of have a few of these carryover members that are now shepherding in these tremendous younger rookie-ish classes. Obviously 2023 probably being the pinnacle of the Spiders, but the past couple have been good. I mean, you bring up Keenan Lawrence, another name that I think deserves recognition. There are two names, Chris Long, who is the 2022 All-Star representative for the team. He just came off of, I think, his most dynamic season. You'd still like to see a few of his turnovers numbers pick up, but playing in that specific stadium that Oakland does, I know that there's a wind vortex in there that causes a kind of preponderance of turnovers. You look at some of their results last year, it's like 40 plus turnovers combined for both teams. So you can excuse that, but I digress. We got Chris Long as well as Evan Magsig, one of my favorite personal developing players as an all-around figure in this league. 2 years ago, it felt like he was going to be a almost like A-Roy clone as far as like a possession-based kind of pivot center handler who's got a deep bag, maybe doesn't always huck it, but just has a lot of throwing capacity. And then this past season, he showed so much more athleticism and playmaking potential. I mean, he had a couple of sequences where he would get a layout block or a hand block and go score. The bookends, I just like Magsig, Lawrence, Lung, that kind of inner, that tweener stage between, they're not quite solidified as stars, but we can't quite regard them as young guns either. And then you've got the Dexter Cliburns, the Raekwon Atkins, the Dylan Nice, this just Matt Barcelos. You know, they get Kyle Lewin to throw a game winner in one of their games. Walker Frankenberg was the runner up from Rookie of the Year and was the unanimous pick for Rookie of the Year at the midway point until Lucas Ambrose just went supernova in the second half of the season with his block totals. But I digress. Oakland has so much going for them. My worry about them is just the capacity in the West for playoff teams. I mean, they missed the postseason last year. They haven't made the postseason since 2017. They have teams like LA, Colorado, and Salt Lake above them who all also kind of carry blueprints similar to their own and that they have a good mix of veteran and young. The only hesitation I have with Oakland is just, again, that predicament they find themselves in, a very full West division.
Yes. And that's hard, but they were also, right, they were up in the playoff picture until the last week of the season, right? It came down to that last game, that last weekend.
They had to lose back-to-back games in order to fall out of the playoffs. So it was completely in their own destiny, and it's just, it was so kind of awful in a sense to watch a young team sort of fully lean into the possibility of, yeah, we're just going to kick this away ourselves, you know?
They totally leaned into, like, it really was like you looked at LA, who was storming back into the playoff picture. They have Pavel Giannis, this guy who, you know, he's established AUD or UFA veteran. He's been to big games. He's been to championship weekend. He knows what it takes. And then you have the young team who's not been there before, who doesn't have that Pavel Giannis-like player. And you know, it's not all Pavel. Obviously, there are lots of contributors on that LA team, but sometimes you just need a guy who's like been there before and has the confidence that like you can do it and like knows what that looks like, knows what those big games feel like, can be a calming presence. Guys like him and Jason Valley, who also came over from Chicago, who was also a part of those runs in the playoffs. Let's not forget that they almost knocked off the Flyers in 2021, taking them to overtime in that semifinals game before the Flyers eventually go on to win the championship game. So like they clearly had played in big games and Oakland very much looked like they hadn't. And, you know, that experience can be the thing that propels them forward going into this season, or it can be the thing that festers and breaks them in the offseason. I'm much more on the propels them forward side with how much youth they have and how much energy they seem to play with. I think that that's just going to motivate them and excite them going into this next year.
And I really like what Dan Silverstein has been developing there as a coach as well. I think some of their offensive principles, the way that they kind of can put almost 5, 6, 7 throwers on a field. I mean, you talk about the development of Dexter Clyburn and Raekwon Adkins as they kind of start to limit some of those mistakes. I mean, their skill as throwers is unquestionable. I mean, I don't know if you've seen it, that Raekwon Adkins thrower, the wind-up deliver backhand that he had in that final regular season meeting with LA, I mean, that's just pure form, right? And like that's what Oakland has. They have that pure potential. It's just, can they tap into it? And can they tap into it quick enough to compete with this West Division that's already producing championship game quality contenders in Salt Lake and possibly Colorado and maybe even LA now here with them kind of arriving on the scene, I think, a little bit sooner than we thought into the Pavel Giannis tenure of his 6-year contract now entering year two. But I before we wrap up this episode, I just kind of wanted to give my two picks. I totally agree with you on Oakland. I also wanted to kind of dovetail off of them and say LA too. I feel like LA arrived so much again sooner than we had anticipated. And I think that's due to, again, that youth development that they have. I mean, obviously the Giannis's, the McDougal, the Valley, the veteran presences and the winning that they brought in that melded with the existing sort of McDougal again. I know that they brought him in, but he's sort of been a part of their center for many, many years. McDougal, Steiner, sort of these other presences. But then they've had the development of their young end of Ambrose and Shapiro and even Marcel Osborne. You know, these players that are Matt Miller coming up and stepping into larger roles have been so successful. I really like LA's bones structured blueprint for maybe getting to that next level. Another team, and as much as I malign them, I am such huge fans of them, despite their social media presences at times. Philly, you talk about a coach that's putting in a system that I believe in. I think that's what Roger Chu is doing there. They're kind of leading with a defensive first principle, which is, again, something that we've talked about as being so important in this era. They've got Paul Owens, Eric Whitmer, these other defensive presences. It almost feels like it's time maybe to switch James Pollard back over to D-line. Something that I've been stewing on a bit. They just have so many playmakers on offense. Maybe you do kind of like a Holzmeier, a bit more of a hybridization role. Who knows? I really like what Philly's got cooking up out there. I just think that they're on the precipice. They show enough of an ability to punch. They have been one of the closer contenders with New York in their battles the past two regular seasons, despite not getting over that hump, despite not getting a win against DC, despite kind of feeling like they're not quite on that platform yet. They've got that thing. They've got all of these elements that we've been talking about: the size, the playmaking, the system, the structure, the combination of veterans who have been there that were there for Philly's bad years as they've started to transition into now a little bit more winning and success. And I feel like bringing that whole bandwagon carriage along is such an important part of the journey. They feel a little similar to almost like a different version of like a Radicals, where it's just that like out from under sort of thing. I don't know. I like Philly. I don't know if they're going to arrive this year. I don't know if they'll be able to leapfrog Boston. I don't know if they'll be able to finally knock off one of these close games with DC or New York, but they're getting the reps and it just feels like their time is coming and they're still on their upward trajectory. They still got so much more juice left, I think, in the squeeze.
Yeah, they've got so many pieces that are still like in the prime of their careers. And they defensively, like you said, they're a defensively led team and they are so punchy on defense. If they can get just the littlest bit more efficient offensively and not fall into the trap of just throwing jump balls. And especially, like I know I mentioned before, sometimes James Pollard gets a little huck happy, but I would much rather him be on the other end. I've seen that dude go up against some of the best in the league, and he seems to come down with it pretty dang often. I think I remember seeing him pull one down on Yacht last year, and I'm just like, if you're going down there and pulling one down on a guy who, like, no one pulls this down on, right? Like, Ben Yacht's the guy in the air who you expect to win every matchup, and James Pollard just does not care what the rest of us think about that or what Ben Yacht might think about it. I would much rather him be the one down there instead of throwing as many hucks as he has. And, you know, if we get a year from Jordan Ryan that was more similar to his 2022 season than his season last year, I think they can. I mean, they can take that third spot. And, you know, if things go well, they have played DC and New York really tightly. Maybe they take a couple games, and who knows what happens then. Maybe it's going to be pure chaos out east. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, I think if Philly elevates, you know, a half step more, they could be an absolute monkey wrench in the complete picture of the East Division playoff race. But we'll get into that more in the coming weeks as we hopefully get more roster announcements. We're still very slow on signings at this point in the year, but thankfully, we will have the full 2024 UFA schedule available next week. We will be discussing some of our most anticipated matchups of the upcoming season on next week's episode, but that will do it for this week's episode of Swing Pass. Cam and I, thank you so much for joining us. We will be talking to you in not too long. Until then, we say goodbye.